Back in 2017, when we started Gone Cold, we often spoke about our friend Christina's blog at thetruecrimefiles.com. Needless to say, we were elated in 2019 when Christina put the True Crime Files to podcast with the help of co-host Scott Fuller. Well, we're still huge fans of both thetruecrimefiles.com and the podcast. If you're a regular Gone Cold listener, we think it's safe to say you'll be a huge fan too. We'll let Christina take it from here.
Hi, I'm Christine, and I'd like to introduce you to the True Crime Files podcast, a bi-weekly podcast that focuses on mysterious disappearances and unsolved murders. Every 2 weeks, we'll be releasing an episode that'll help you get to know a case really well without having to invest a lot of your time. Derived from the articles up on the True Crime Files website, you'll find that our show covers a diversity of victims and perspectives. You'll probably also notice that our episodes are narrated by Scott Fuller from the Frozen Truth and Status Pending podcasts. Be sure to subscribe to the True Crime Files today so that you never miss an episode. Thanks so much for listening, being a part of our true crime community, and helping to shine a light on cases that might otherwise be overlooked or underreported.
The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Located roughly 40 miles north of Austin, on the westernmost edge of Bell County, Killeen, Texas was founded in 1882 after the land was purchased by the railroad to extend tracks through the area the prior year. After the tracks were built, construction on 72 city blocks began on the town named after railroad executive Frank P. Killeen, a man who wasn't from the area and in fact had never even stepped foot there. Immediately following the lumberyard, grist mills, and cotton gins to the area were a couple saloons, followed by, of course, drunk gunslingers, who would often take their disagreements and pistols to the city streets for settling up. By the early 1890s, lawlessness had gotten so out of hand in Killeen that the town was incorporated as an official Texas city just to bring in law enforcement to settle things down. The half-decade or so after that were fairly low-key in the area. It was sparsely populated and consisted mostly of cotton farmers and gin workers. Though the Texas legislature's approval and subsequent building of bridges over area streams just after the turn of the 20th century nearly doubled the population of Killeen, bringing it to 1,300, and President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal brought paved roads along with public water and sewage systems after the Great Depression, it wasn't until the construction of Camp Hood that the city's population and development really took off. When the U.S. entered World War II, the immediate need to train soldiers to fight Germany's sophisticated war machine technology transformed Killeen, Texas, from a modest but significant cotton producer into little more than a military boomtown. The city lost half of its trade center to Camp Hood. The farming and ranching economies were virtually destroyed, as were the businesses related to them. Though 1,000 or so citizens left, they were replaced by about the same number of transplants in the form of soldiers, their families, and Camp Hood construction workers. In 1950, 5 years after the devastating bombs that ended World War II were dropped, Camp Hood was established as a permanent army base and renamed Fort Hood. Killeen's population saw more than a 1,500% increase by 1955, growing to around 21,000 residents. The economy continued to grow for the next several decades, save a few hiccups in the form of recessions here and there. By 1990, Killeen was a full-fledged city with 63,000 residents within its limits, and over a quarter of a million folks made up the Killeen-Temple-Fort Hood metropolitan area. The 1990s brought with them more than just continued growth. Alongside this steady rise in population and endurance of a relatively stable economy, something else also was on the rise: the city's murder boom. In fact, if you don't live there but are familiar with Killeen, there's a decent chance it's for one of two things. First, the controversies surrounding the disappearances and deaths of military men and women there. And beyond the jaw-dropping number of Army veterans and Fort Hood-stationed soldiers murdered and missing in Killeen, a phenomenon that continues to this day with seemingly no end in sight, the city is also well-known, perhaps best-known, for what was the deadliest single-gunman mass shooting in the United States until 2007's Virginia Tech Massacre. On October 16, 1991, 35-year-old George Joe Hennard smashed his pickup through the front window of Luby's cafeteria in Killeen during lunch rush. Hennard exited the truck and proceeded to meticulously stalk the restaurant, picking out who he would slay in cold blood. Before his suicide, as the police cornered him, Hennard had executed 23 people and injured 27 by shooting them at point-blank range using 9mm semi-automatic handguns. Years later, in 1997, another heinous crime occurred, one that shook and most certainly shaped Killeen. But unlike the Luby's Cafeteria Massacre, it's been all but forgotten outside the area. This is the tragic story of the kidnapping and murder of 7-year-old Denadia Thompson. Denadia Betty Jacqueline Thompson was born in Killeen, Texas, on March 5, 1990, to parents James and Gayla. Denadia was a big personality and affectionately known by just about everyone as Nene. Though she and her slightly older brother, Delane, often teamed up against their older sister, Danielle, the only way either of them could possibly gain an upper hand, Denadia was an all-around sweet and loving girl. She was one of those kids, by all accounts, whose intelligence and curiosity came naturally and seemed effortless. Once Denadia became school-aged, her love for learning shone bright. She breezed through her work as a first grader with diligence and pride. As the end of her first grade year drew nearer, 7-year-old Denadia was happy and confident, and like so many other little girls, her daily style choices sometimes changed last minute. They certainly did on the morning of Wednesday, April 30th, 1997. As Denadia's mother, Gayla, prepared her, 9-year-old Delane, and 13-year-old Danielle for school, 7-year-old Denadia decided at the last minute that a ponytail was going to be the appropriate hairstyle for the day. So, Gayla pulled back her hair and secured it with a tie, one with those big black marble-looking things. Gayla loaded the kids in the car and headed to Denadia's grandmother's house, where they went most mornings, as did two of their cousins. Denadia's middle name was in honor, in fact, of her grandmother. As they hopped out of the car to go inside Grandma's, Denadia grabbed her backpack, turned to her mother, and said, "I love you, Mom." Marlborough Elementary School, now called Jackson Professional Learning Center, was about 4 blocks from Denadia's grandmother's house. At around 7:35 a.m., she, Delane, Danielle, and their two cousins set out for the day's classes and to eat breakfast at the school's cafeteria. 13-year-old Danielle walked the younger kids to Reverend Abercrombie Drive, where Marlborough Elementary was in sight, before heading to her school, Manor Middle, where she was a 7th grader. As Danielle walked away toward her school, Denadia told her big sister she loved her. Later, the excitement of the day's final school bell sent Marlborough Elementary into chaos. The kids couldn't get out of class to enjoy the evening fast enough. 9-year-old Delane Thompson made his way through the thick of it to meet his sister Denadia and their cousins at the same spot they all met every day, so they could walk back to Grandma's together. His two cousins arrived, and the three goofed off some as they waited for Denadia. They waited and waited for what seemed like an eternity, but Denadia never showed. After the steady flow of loud and anxious children slowed to a trickle, Delane and his cousins split up and searched the school grounds. The 7-year-old was nowhere to be found. Thinking Denadia had broken routine and headed back to Grandma's on her own, they began that route themselves. Walking back from Manor Middle School, Denadia and Delane's 13-year-old sister, Danielle, met her brother and cousins near Reverend Abercrombie Drive. As she prepared to race them home, as was the usual routine, her heart skipped a beat as her thoughts caught up with her eyes. Denadia wasn't with Delane and their cousins, and she knew immediately that something was wrong. But still, Danielle could not have possibly comprehended at that moment the nightmare that had just begun. Between the podcast, the dreaded day job, and family responsibilities, I don't get a ton of time to myself. When I do, I make the most of it by busting out a few levels of the only match 3 puzzle game for me, Best Fiends. This past weekend, we got snowed in here in North Texas, which gave me the perfect excuse to get in some extra playtime. No matter what's going on around me, I can lose myself in a few minutes of Best Fiends. Now, I totally dig the little bugs and other small creatures that make up my slug-busting army and the game's bright colors, but it's the differing strategies each and every level that keeps me coming back, that keeps my brain engaged while playing. I'm all the way up to level 5626 as I speak, so obviously I'm hooked. And since new levels are added all the time, I never run out. So take a little time for yourself and download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. When Denadia Thompson didn't show up to meet her cousins, brother Delane, and sister Danielle to walk home together after school on Wednesday, April 30th, 1997, the children figured, or hoped, that she'd simply race to their grandmother's house without them. However, when they arrived, Denadia wasn't there either. 9-year-old Delane was worried and snapped right into Big Brother mode, racing back to Marlboro Elementary to look again and ask around. It was around 4 p.m. at this point. School had been out for a while, and Denadia's aunt and big sister, 13-year-old Danielle, followed close behind Delane on foot. They all spoke with a few students that had straggled behind and were still there, but no one had seen Denadia. Danielle and her aunt reported the 7-year-old first grader's disappearance to school officials quickly and found out she'd been marked absent for the day. Denadia never made it to class at all. She'd been missing for almost 8 hours. A call was made to the Killeen police. Moving quickly, the cops began piecing together Denadia Thompson's movements that morning. The girl had made it to school, of course, and although witnesses told detectives they'd seen Denadia and her young family members separate as they approached Marlboro Elementary, she had made it inside the building as she and her brother Delane ate breakfast in the cafeteria together. But Denadia had eaten fast and left the lunchroom alone to get a few minutes at the playground before the school bell rang. It was then and there that witnesses recalled seeing something seemingly harmless at the time, but absolutely blood-chilling in hindsight. At around 8 a.m., as Denadia was having fun on the playground, a man approached the fence that surrounded it. At a gap in that fence, this man called out to Denadia by name. The two talked briefly. Presumably, the several individuals who witnessed this were too far to hear the short conversation. After the strange man and Donatia had spoken for a minute or so, he scooped up the first grader and she climbed on his back. This situation, of course, allowed for little other reaction than great alarm, and when police discovered another witness who'd seen the man and the little girl two blocks away, fear for her safety escalated even more. That witness was a neighbor of the Thompson family, who recognized Donatia. The sighting was at approximately 8:30 a.m. at the corner of Jeffries Street and U.S. Highway 190. The young girl didn't seem to be under duress, the witness told police, and was still riding piggyback on the man who not one of the witnesses recognized. Searches performed that evening were fruitless, the darkness only further obscuring any trace of the missing girl. The following day, Thursday, May 1st, word about the abduction of Donatia Thompson spread around Killeen fast, particularly in her community on the east side. Missing persons flyers were created quickly and hung virtually everywhere in the city. Volunteers came in droves to help search for the first grader, including relatives, neighbors, and Fort Hood soldiers. Searchers were combing through vacant lots, fields, alleyways, and area parks around Marlboro Elementary. A radius of approximately 3 miles around the school was carefully searched, and folks all over town kept up a watchful eye. The search parties worked into the next day, never letting up. By Saturday, May 2nd, 1997, a local radio station lent a plane and pilot to the search efforts. A U.S. Customs chopper was also sent in, as was a tracking dog, courtesy of the Williamson County Sheriff's Office. Formed after the still-unsolved abduction and murder of 11-year-old Heidi Seaman in 1990, San Antonio-based the Heidi Search Center sent five of their own to aid in locating 7-year-old Donatia Thompson. These volunteers had come straight from Friendswood, Texas, where they'd participated in the large-scale search of Laura Kate Smither, a 12-year-old girl who'd disappeared earlier in the month. Searchers had found Laura's body, but the case didn't close until 20 years later, when serial rapist and killer of young women and little girls, William Lewis Reese, finally confessed to her murder, among others, in 2015. Heidi Search and Recovery quickly organized the many volunteers into separate parties and gave a crash course in the best and most effective methods to conduct searches, freeing up time for the Killeen police to investigate by speaking with witnesses and attempting to identify and question known sex offenders and other criminals in the area. Organizers immediately took their message to television news crews and Killeen Daily Herald newspaper reporters to plead their case for more volunteers. Folks sitting at home in front of their TVs should be out looking for the girl, they said, and funds were needed quickly. The faster a reward could be offered to entice witnesses to come forward, Heidi Search officials said, the more likely the chance they'd find the missing first grader. On the local news, Donatia's mother, Gayla Thompson, pleaded for her missing daughter to call home and thanked the many volunteers who'd joined the efforts. On Sunday, Donatia's father, James Thompson, arrived from Benton Harbor, Michigan. The girl's distraught grandfather, Al Taylor, continued to head up searches in North Killeen. Then came Monday. Though volunteers and authorities hadn't relented, absolutely no trace of the missing girl had been found. On May 5th, 1997, a composite sketch of the man seen giving Donatia Thompson a piggyback ride away from Marlboro Elementary was released. He was described as a dark-complexioned black man, around 26 years old, 5 feet 10 inches tall, and slender. His nose was described as thin, his mustache as thick, and his hairstyle a short afro. The man wore a black waist-length jacket, black baggy pants, and light-colored tennis shoes. Though the Killeen police wouldn't comment on motive, and in fact told reporters they didn't know of one, it seemed obvious from the get-go that the intent behind the abduction of this little girl was a dark and depraved one. Donatia's father lived in Michigan, so a custody dispute could be ruled out immediately. And since witnesses didn't recognize this man, and family didn't recognize the description necessarily, it seemed he was a stranger to most relatives, friends, and neighbors, but perhaps not to Donatia herself, since he was heard calling her out by name, and since she appeared to be in no distress. When they released the composite sketch, police also pleaded for a possible witness to come forward. This person was driving south on Jeffries Street at about 8:15 the morning Donatia Thompson was kidnapped. As they came to a stop behind another vehicle, who was letting pedestrians cross, the driver began honking their horn in an attempt to hurry along the small traffic jam. It's unclear if the cops truly sought the driver as a witness, or if they believed he or she was involved in the kidnapping. A reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of Donatia Thompson's abductor was quickly established by police and other donors and announced on Tuesday, May 6th. By the Wednesday following her disappearance, thousands of civilian volunteers had joined in the search for the 7-year-old. Many came from nearby Austin and others from as far as Dallas. Because of the discovery of 12-year-old Laura Kate Smithers' body just a little over a week before they traveled to Killeen to begin searching for 7-year-old Donatia Thompson, organizers with Heidi Search and Recovery might have hoped to find the missing girl alive, but perhaps expected the worst possible outcome. After all, tragic stories of the abductions and murders of children and teenagers had been flooding the news cycle all over Texas in the recent past. Besides Laura Smithers' kidnapping and slaying in Friendswood, the still unsolved slaying of 9-year-old Amber Hagerman in Arlington in January of the previous year remained in the news cycle. The kidnappings of 9-year-old Cody Patterson and 11-year-old Sarah Patterson in Granbury, the very same day of Donatia's abduction, were all over newspaper headlines and television news reports. Cody was found badly injured but alive, luckily. However, when his mother's boyfriend was apprehended, while folks 120 miles away in Killeen searched for Donatia Thompson, it was discovered this man had raped and killed Sarah Patterson. The national news couldn't even relent from the hellish reality of child snatching and murder. In Beaumont, California, 10-year-old Anthony Martinez disappeared on April 4, 1997, and was found in an Indio desert 2 weeks later. But until it happened in their own backyard, Killeen residents only had a passing fear that one of their own would become victim to such a monster. 8 days after Donatia was abducted, her family and the city of Killeen's nightmare was realized when she was found. A half mile north of the Lampasas River, at around 9:30 a.m. on Thursday, May 8, 1997, two Fort Hood soldiers searching the brushy roadside along Texas State Highway 195, about 10 miles south of the city of Killeen in rural Bell County, discovered a plastic trash bag in the ditch about 15 feet from the road to the west. It was far enough off the highway that passersby likely didn't even notice it, and further hidden anyway by overgrown grass and fully bloomed wildflowers. The plastic was frayed and torn both from the elements and animal activity. Protruding from it were human remains. Killeen police were called to the scene right away. Items found inside the plastic bag alongside the remains and the body's size led police to immediately speculate that it was 7-year-old Denadia Thompson. Police did not disclose what items led them to that presumption, but likely it was the clothing. The placement of the body in the plastic bag was thought to have accelerated the decomposition. Temperatures, too, had been particularly hot for the late spring, with highs in the low 90 degrees Fahrenheit, also accelerating the decay. The remains were not easily identifiable by sight. Clues around the scene were sparse, and police could not ascertain if the bag and body were thrown from a moving vehicle or walked to and placed where it was found. A cause of death was not readily apparent, partially due to the advanced stage of decomposition. Police called off the searches pending identification and publicly announced the discovery. Denadia's mother, Gayla Thompson, was shattered by the news. In fact, she was transported to a local hospital after she fainted. Though the remains weren't officially identified as her daughter's, she knew they were. The police told her as much. Though he knew it was a nightmare for any family, Denadia's father, James Thompson, held out hope that it was not his daughter. The body was sent to the Southwest Institute of Forensic Sciences in Dallas for autopsy and to be ID'd by anthropologist Kimball Smith. It wasn't until weeks later, on May 30, 1997, that it was finally announced officially that the remains were identified as Denadia Thompson. Killeen police declined to comment on Denadia's cause of death, and in fact, have not released that information to this day. Also kept close to the chest was whether Denadia Thompson was raped. However, theorizing any motive besides sexual assault seems difficult. Family members were, of course, scrutinized. But more than once, Killeen police detectives had said publicly that relatives had nothing to do with it. Apparently, the rumor mill was suggesting otherwise, as rumor mills often do. But other incidents only strengthened the notion that family was not involved in any way. On the other side of town in southwest Killeen in early June, a little girl ran away as a man attempted to get her into his van. Police were quick to quell fears by telling the media that this was being investigated, but it was not yet considered to be connected to Denadia Thompson's abduction. At least, not at first. When a composite sketch of the attempted abductor was created, it turned out to resemble the suspect in Denadia's kidnapping and murder. Days before that, at about 6:30 p.m. on May 28th, in nearby Temple, Texas, a mother turned her back to her 2-year-old boy as he sat playing on the front steps of their apartment unit. When she turned back around, the mother said, a strange man was leading her son away by his hand. She ran toward the man screaming, and he fled. The FBI became involved and began exploring the idea that these cases were all related. Whatever the conclusion was, it was never commented on again publicly. The abduction and murder of Denadia Thompson went cold almost as soon as it took place. By late June 1997, all leads had been followed, and Lieutenant Lee Caulfield is quoted saying that the department had no more directions to go in. At that point, the cops had received over 2,000 tips from the general public. Denadia's name faded from the headlines. Killeen homicide detective Fred Harris picked up Denadia's case in 2011. Harris gave credit to the hard work of the detectives before him, those who laid the groundwork for the significant leads he uncovered in 2013 under the public's radar. The year he came on the case, Detective Harris said he would refuse offers for a promotion until he's apprehended Denadia's killer. So far, he's kept his word. In the initial investigation, a strong person of interest was indeed identified, only the cops never found the man to question him. In 2015, Killeen police publicly pleaded for a witness to come forward. In the plea, they said a woman named Maria LaShawn Taylor might have information about Donatia's murder. Taylor is, or was at the time, a resident of Caldwell, about 80 miles southeast of Killeen, the police said, but frequented the Temple, Killeen area regularly. She was called a key witness in the police attempts to find her. It's unclear if detectives ever spoke with Taylor. By 2018, Detective Harris said, new leads emerged that will likely lead to resolution after police followed up on tips with a series of polygraphs, hypnosis sessions, and interestingly, handwriting statement analysis. He strongly believes, Harris said, that he knows who killed Donatia. He just needs the right evidence. Killeen Police Detective Fred Harris continues to work diligently on Donatia's case, going into his 11th year of doing so. With recent advancements in forensic science and Harris's willingness to do whatever it takes to bring Donatia's killer to justice, it seems like only a matter of time before it happens. If you have any information about the abduction and murder of 7-year-old Donatia Betty Jacqueline Thompson, please contact Bell County Crime Stoppers at 254-526-8477. The Austin American Statesman, the Killeen Daily Herald, the Marshall News Messenger, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and KCEN-TV archival footage were used as sources for this episode. You can support the show at patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. There, you can get the show ad-free and enjoy Patreon-exclusive episodes that tell stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them. I get those out as much as I can, which is not as often as I would like. We also donate some proceeds to DNASolves.com and the Fort Worth Cold Case Support Group. Speaking of those two great causes, you can help solve cold cases and help identify Jane and John Doe's by supporting one of the many crowdfunding efforts at DNASolves.com, and you can upload your DNA data to the database there. It's only used for law enforcement investigations. DNA Solves is Othram Incorporated, the folks who solved the Carla Walker case alongside the Fort Worth Police Department. If you want to help the Fort Worth Police solve a cold case, you can donate directly to them at fwpdcoldcasesupport.org. We'll provide a link to both DNA Solves and the Fort Worth Police Cold Case Support Group in the episode's show notes. Another way you can support Gone Cold is by leaving us a 5-star rating and written review on iTunes or wherever else you listen. Those reviews help Gone Cold's visibility, which helps new listeners find us, which increases the potential for someone with information hearing the show and reporting what they know to authorities. We appreciate more than words can express any support you give Gone Cold, DNASolves.com, the Fort Worth Police Cold Case Support Group, or any other folks whose cause is to provide long overdue justice to victims or the families of victims. So, thank you in advance. Thanks for listening, y'all.